So we are honored to have you with us today. Welcome, Dr. Tarnopolsky. If you're joining us, and I'd like to just direct you to follow along with the slides for today's presentation, please visit phytoaction.org, and then you'll see the link for exercise, nutrition, and mitochondrial disease. Click on that link, and in the Join Us box, you'll see a place to view the slides. We will have an opportunity for questions at the end of today's presentation, and if you'd like to be sure that your question is asked or we could ask on your behalf, feel free to email us, director@mitoaction.org, or you can email Mary Beth, mito411@mitoaction.org, or you can save your question till the end. So, Dr. Tarnopolsky, thank you so much again for joining us today. I'm going to hand it over to you and let you get us started.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. So as mentioned, I'm a specialist in neuromuscular and metabolic disorders, and my main area of interest are mitochondrial disorders. And we also study aging, because with human aging, there definitely is mitochondrial dysfunction. And with our older adults, we're able to do much more invasive studies, such as muscle biopsies and catheters and such, to better understand the biochemistry and the molecular biology of mitochondrial dysfunction, and to try and come up with what we call countermeasures or therapies that might help our patients who may not be as willing to give us multiple muscle biopsies. And one of the things that we've spent a lot of time looking at is exercise with and without nutritional interventions. So if we turn to the first slide, just from a disclosure perspective, I've worked with a number of companies in the past who have and still do provide mitochondrial diagnostic services. Some of these companies are interested in different therapeutics, some with an overlap with mitochondria, some not. And at the very bottom, the most relevant is that I'm the CEO and founder of a company called Exerkine, where we're trying to identify factors that are released in response to exercise which have multisystemic mitochondrial benefits, and to try and come up with therapies for our children and adults with severe mitochondrial disease who, because of their disorder, are not able to exercise. So if we turn to the next slide, this is essentially what we do in the clinic and my research program. We're a mitochondrial-centric lab. That's why the mitochondria are at the center of this. And if you turn to your right, you can see at the top strength and at the bottom endurance. So when we think of somebody exercising, if you do high-intensity contractions, for example, lifting weights, one gets what's called hypertrophy, or an increase in muscle mass, which leads to an increase in strength. If you do endurance exercise, which is longer duration, less intense contractions, anywhere for, you know, some people can run up to 2 or 3 hours, that type of activity tends to cause mitochondrial biogenesis, or new mitochondria. And certainly understanding how the body either adapts to weight training to combat weakness or increases mitochondrial biogenesis to improve mitochondrial function is clearly relevant for those that either have mitochondrial disease or muscle atrophy or a combination of both. So if you look to the left, these are the two things that we see in the clinic. In the muscle side of things, muscular dystrophy and some mitochondrial disease leads to atrophy, which is the opposite of hypertrophy or strength, and that thin muscle becomes weak, and that leads to functional limitations. And on the bottom, we have mitochondrial dysfunction, which is completely the opposite of, you know, a top sport athlete who has mitochondrial biogenesis. So with all of the interventions and research that we do on the right in healthy people, our clinic and our lab is trying to find drugs, nutrition, and exercise therapies to try and improve people's function who might suffer from atrophy or mitochondrial disease. And I think where mitochondrial disease is getting a real buy-in and certainly more research dollars is the realization that a host of other disorders that affect people have mitochondrial dysfunction as a secondary component. So things like obesity, type 2 diabetes, even immobilization. So for example, we put a knee immobilization brace, such as one might have if you had knee surgery, on young college students. And after 2 weeks, we had a reduction in mitochondrial function by almost 30%. So you can see that something as simple or as unfortunate as breaking your ankle or having knee surgery, where a cast is on for at least 6 weeks, that alone can significantly impact mitochondrial function. And it's even more important in patients who have pre-existing muscular dystrophy or mitochondrial dysfunction to get them mobilized again, knowing that there's going to be a superimposed damage. So if we turn to the next slide and we jump right into nutrition. So one of the most important things, I think, is, you know, is the diet good enough for people who have muscular dystrophy and mitochondrial disease? Now, in this study here, where entitled Nutritional Inadequacy in Patients with Muscular Dystrophy, you might say, well, what relevance is that to me if I have mitochondrial disease? Essentially, and I'll show you in a minute, we repeated this study in patients with mitochondrial disease and found the same thing. So everything that I talk about here is just as relevant to mitochondrial disease. So in this study, we had 51 adults who had muscular dystrophy and 14 boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is the more severe form. And we did dietary records where we had them record everything that they ate for 3 days. And we did that again 5 months later and took the average, and we compared it to the Canadian and U.S. Recommended dietary reference intake. Which in Canada and the U.S. now we have a harmonized intake, which says how many vitamins, calories, minerals are we supposed to take in. So on the next slide, what this shows is the percentage of patients who were not meeting the current recommendations for healthy eating. And in white, I have adults. In green, I have pediatric patients. So the first, which I think is why this is happening, is energy intake is often low. So you can see that 68% and 64% of patients were not getting enough energy. And the problem there is that if you're not taking in enough calories, you're not bringing in enough vitamins and minerals and proteins. And we think that's where the problem is. And part of the reason why that happens is you can imagine if someone has muscular dystrophy and is in a wheelchair, they're not moving very much. So they're not burning energy, so they don't take in as much. And the same may be true of mitochondrial disease where, you know, exercise intolerance or contractures or being in a wheelchair would limit energy intake. So as we go down, you can see there's a variety of vitamins, vitamin A, C, D, E, and K, where upwards of almost 100% of patients are not meeting the current guidelines. You can see there for vitamin E, it's 98% of patients weren't even taking in enough vitamin E to meet their daily requirements. And the list goes on and on. And why this is important is some of these vitamins, like vitamin B12, for example, if they're deficient, they lead to symptoms very similar to what happens in mitochondrial disease. So, for example, I have patients with vitamin B12 deficiency who come in with peripheral neuropathy, spasticity, spinal cord problems, and in the worst case, if it's not treated, dementia. And all of those things can occur in mitochondrial disease. So the one thing that's important is that you don't want to miss a deficiency in a patient who has a pre-existing genetic disease because you can do something about the deficiency. So you know, we call it low-hanging fruit. Don't miss something that, if deficient, is going to exacerbate or create new symptoms for the patient. So if we turn to the next slide, this is just our original study where we had 9 mitochondrial disease patients, but we've now done this in about 36 patients with the same results. And what we found is that about 14% of our patients were clinically obese. So that thing called BMI is body mass index, and we found that in the mitochondrial patients, 14% were obese. And generally what we think of when we think of mitochondrial disease are, you know, the patient with Kearns-Sayre syndrome or Milas syndrome, who's incredibly thin. But, you know, what we found is when we actually put people on a special thing called a DEXA scan, 14% of them actually had too much body fat. And that can be a problem because that can increase the risk of things like diabetes, and it also makes it harder to get around. We found about the same proportion were too small, were too skinny, which is generally what most people think. But it wasn't as high as we thought. It was only in the order of about 14% were too thin and didn't have enough body mass. And again, many patients weren't taking in enough energy, and patients also were not taking enough protein and some of the other vitamins as well. So we'll go to the next slide. So what we did is we said, well, if people don't seem to be eating very much and they're not getting the current recommendations, is this actually having an impact? Are people, in fact, deficient in certain vitamins? So we look back on almost 2,000 patients, including a large number with mitochondrial disease, and we looked at red blood cell folic acid, vitamin B12, vitamin A, and vitamin D and E. And if we go to the next slide, so what we have here are the vitamin levels, from left to right, this is red blood cell folic acid, vitamin B12, vitamin A, vitamin D, and vitamin E. And you can see here that, for example, B12, which I mentioned before, about 13% of our patients with neuropathy and almost 17% with mitochondrial disease had low vitamin B12. And that is absolutely essential not to miss because, as I mentioned, low B12 can cause peripheral neuropathy, spasticity in the legs, spinal cord dysfunction, and even dementia if it's untreated. So I think a lot of folks, you know, in my area who are treating genetic disease forget about the simple stuff, and that is, you know, don't miss a deficiency. Vitamin D deficiency, in this case, is underestimated. So the levels that we had here were for vitamin D levels that were so low that it could cause rickets. And why that's important is that if levels are that low, it also causes muscle weakness and it causes a high CK or muscle enzyme. And what you can see here is that about 12% of our patients with mitochondrial disease had vitamin D levels that were in the rickets range, and also that can cause a myopathy. There are new current Canadian guidelines that are out, and with the new current guidelines, which are as relevant in Canada as they are in the U.S., 85% of our patients would be deemed deficient. Now, that's not to say that they're going to get rickets and they're going to get muscle disease, but they are at increased risk for osteoporosis and diabetes as they get older. But again, certainly we wouldn't want to miss that 12% or so who have extremely low levels. And it's so easy to treat. Essentially, 2,000 units of vitamin D will keep about 98% of the population well above this lower range. So if we go to the next slide here. Are there other deficiencies that are relevant to mitochondrial disease? First one is carnitine. So a lot of you may be on carnitine. We don't think, and the research doesn't show, that carnitine does anything if your levels are normal. However, the same principle that we apply to vitamins, if they're low, it makes sense to replace it because carnitine is involved in bringing fat into the mitochondria. So if it's low, we have to replace it, and we usually recommend 10 to 15 milligrams per kilogram per day. But again, every clinical center in Canada and the U.S. can measure total and free carnitine and determine whether your levels are low, and if they are, we'd recommend replacement with L-carnitine. Now, MELAS is a special situation, and what was found is that citrulline, which is an amino acid, which is used to make something called nitric oxide, is often low. And so the problem there is that if we have low nitric oxide, the blood vessels can go into spasm. And it was thought initially by a Japanese group that part of the stroke-like episodes that occur in MELAS syndrome was due to low citrulline and low arginine, which are similar amino acids. And therefore, there was decreased nitric oxide and the vessels went into spasm. So for our patients with MELAS syndrome who've had strokes and seizures, in an acute setting, we use a fairly large intravenous bolus of what's called arginine to make more nitric oxide, and then we put them on oral supplements, usually 1 gram twice a day. And there is some new evidence that citrulline may be at least as effective, if not maybe a little bit more. Work out of one of my colleagues, Fernando Scaglia, showed that. So if we turn to the next level, from a habitual diet perspective, as I mentioned, a lot of patients are not eating enough and their energy intake is low. Part of that is usually because people aren't moving very much, but for some people it may be difficult to swallow. For example, our patients with chronic progressive external ophthalmoplegia, which is by far and away the most common mitochondrial disease in adults, about 60% or so of our patients have significant dysphagia, which means that they have problems swallowing. So if you have a problem swallowing, you tend to fear swallowing, and people tend to avoid food, and that can lead to a loss of muscle mass and not getting enough vitamins and minerals. So certainly in patients who have mitochondrial disease, if there is what's called dysphagia, which means it's hard to swallow solids or liquids, we would recommend a swallowing study. For most of our patients, in fact, every patient pretty much that we see, unless they're doing a lot of exercise and eating a very good diet, we would recommend taking a balanced multivitamin. So we usually recommend a Costco brand multivitamin, a Centrum, this sort of thing. No mega doses of anything, but a good balanced multivitamin that covers the Canadian and U.S. guidelines. We also strongly recommend that the physicians check for deficiencies. So when we first see a patient with mitochondrial disease, unless they're already on supplemental vitamin D, we'll always check their vitamin D. We will check their vitamin B12 because that's a critical one you don't want to miss. And we also found even vitamin E in some patients were low. And vitamin E is an important antioxidant, so we often check that in our mitochondrial patients, although it is part of our supplement that we provide to our patients, which is a not habitual diet, but that's an actual therapy that we use for mitochondrial disease, which we'll talk about later. And I think an important thing that clinicians need to be aware of is that a change in function in a patient with a mitochondrial disease or another genetic disease could be an acquired vitamin deficiency, and so changes need to be monitored because too often I think the doctors think that any deterioration in vision or walking, et cetera, is just the disease itself, and they forget about the simple things. And if there's any of you who have children with mitochondrial disease, when they're very young and they have severe difficulties eating, if they're falling off the growth chart, we usually recommend what's called a G-tube, which is a way to provide feeding directly into the stomach so that kids can get the appropriate nutrition so that they can grow properly. And putting a G-tube in isn't a permanent thing. That can be removed if things do improve in the future. So moving to the next stage, other things with your habitual diet that we recommend. One is we'd suggest avoiding fasting for prolonged periods. So certainly you have to fast when you sleep at night, but generally much longer than 10 hours would probably not be good for people because your mitochondria then are having to work a little harder. There's more fat that's being delivered to the mitochondria. So as a consequence, we would say that 10 hours would be about the maximum that you'd want to push it. We also would recommend more frequent meals. I think a lot of people will eat one or two meals a day, and usually you get full very quickly, and therefore they're not getting enough calories. But if you have more frequent, smaller meals, it's usually easier to get in your meals. Patients that have a complex 1 deficiency, or children with severe seizures, or people with a specific mitochondrial disease called PDH deficiency, we often will try a high-fat diet. And I won't get into the biochemistry behind it, but there's pretty good evidence that there may be some benefit. We definitely would suggest iron supplements if iron is low. So again, treating deficiencies. And how we measure iron in blood is to measure what's called the ferritin. And if the ferritin levels are low, we usually suggest an iron supplement to get those levels into the normal range. And we recheck them to make sure that we don't go too high. And that's important because many of the iron sulfur clusters in our mitochondria, if we have iron deficiency, they don't operate at optimal levels, and therefore staying in the normal range is helpful. Furthermore, if your iron stores are very low, it can lead to restless leg syndrome. Sorry, I'm just got a bad cold, so I'm trying to drink something more. The next thing would be to avoid excessive amounts of alcohol. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have a glass of wine or a beer. It means you don't go out and get drunk. So certainly for a male, 2 to 3 drinks would be pretty much the hard deck, and female, 1 to 2 would be the hard deck if you're having a drink on the weekend sort of thing. If you drink too much, especially if people are continually drinking or they binge drink, it can cause something called a paracrystalline inclusion, which can damage the mitochondria. Patients with Milas syndrome, important to avoid some of the migraine triggers, things like tannins in red wine, aged cheeses, and these sort of things can be triggers for Milas syndrome. So we'd recommend avoiding those. Next slide. So now we'll get into some of the specifics of mitochondrial cocktail. And I thought I'd put this slide up just so people know why your doctors may prescribe the mitochondrial cocktail and what's the rationale behind it. So this is stylized mitochondria. Essentially, the food that you eat feeds in to the pink bars there, complex 1 and complex 2, where that NADH and that FADH2 are feeding in. And the food that we eat is very much like wood in a fire. It gets slowly taken apart, or what we call decarboxylated, and the potential energy goes into the mitochondria, very much like pushing water up to the top of Niagara Falls, and then it flows through at the far right-hand side there through Complex 5, and it generates energy. And that whole system can only work if there's oxygen coming in and food being provided at the Complex 1 and Complex 2. Now, if this doesn't work properly, there's several consequences. One is what you see in red at the top there, that ROS stands for free radicals or reactive oxygen species. And if too many of those are produced, they can damage lipid, they can damage protein, they can damage DNA, and further damage the mitochondria. So part of the mitochondrial cocktail is to provide antioxidants to try and tone down the reactive oxygen species. So with Leber hereditary optic neuropathy, we know that that rapid degeneration of the optic nerve is due to a large increase in reactive oxygen species, and that's been shown in several other mitochondrial diseases as well. You also should be aware that the mitochondria provides most of the energy for cells when oxygen is present, but we have other energy sources in cells. So if the mitochondria don't work, we use sugar and we form lactic acid or lactate. We can also use phosphocreatine. And so the creatine stores in your muscle can provide energy, and creatine is present in every cell in our body. And so that's a consequence if the mitochondria don't work. But all of these are important because they really shape why we started to think about treating mitochondrial disease and what could we do to mitigate or decrease some of these things. So if we turn to the next slide, what are some of the strategies people have had to try and not just prevent deficiencies, but to actually improve mitochondrial function, to what supplements can perhaps overcome the mitochondrial defect? So one of the strategies is called bypassing the defect. So for example, if you have a mutation in complex 1, for example, most of the Leber mutations are complex 1 defects, you can try and bypass that. And that's part of the reason why CoQ10 is used. Ubiquinone or ubiquinol, the reduced and oxidized and reduced form. And CoQ10 is the recipient of electrons from complex 1 and complex 2. So if you have a defect at complex 1, one of the theories is that some of the energy can come from CoQ10 and directly feed into complex 3. Succinate and riboflavin both enhance the function of complex 2, again, to try and bypass the defect. In the old days, people thought just reducing the lactate is important. Now, certainly in a kid with a severe disease, if the lactate's through the roof, there can be negative consequences. But for the most part, the lactate is just an indicator that you have the disease and that your cell is trying to use more glucose. And reducing it really doesn't have a huge benefit. So people tried a drug called dichloroacetate, which we still occasionally use in severe, super high lactates in the intensive care unit, but they tried to use this as a daily supplement. The problem was is that it really didn't improve function in the long run, and it caused some neuropathy, which is damage to the nerves. So nobody is using that at this point in time. Thiamine is a vitamin called vitamin B1, which may provide some support to reduce lactate, but that's pretty controversial. And then the antioxidants, as I mentioned, those free radicals or reactive oxygen species. Vitamin E is a lipid-soluble vitamin which gets through many of the membranes and helps to prevent damage to the lipid component of the cell. Coenzyme Q10, which I already listed there before, and lipoic acid or alpha-lipoic acid is the proper name for it, are antioxidants. And both CoQ10 and alpha-lipoic acid are in the mitochondria. We've been interested in creatine monohydrate, because as I mentioned, phosphocreatine is depleted in the cells as an alternative energy source. And we knew from the athletes that boosting creatine stores with creatine monohydrate increased those stores. And we've shown that that does improve the high intensity performance of people with mitochondrial disease. And a little later on, we'll talk about exercise training. I mentioned the vasodilatation with L-arginine. Again, replacing deficiencies. If one has a folate deficiency, that can be replaced with folic acid. And if it's deficient in the cerebrospinal fluid in kids with more severe disease, sometimes we use folinic acid. And I won't talk about the nucleotide precursors because that isn't available clinically yet. Next slide. So creatine is made in our body from amino acids. It's first made in the kidney, and then it's transported to the liver, where the final touches are put on it, for lack of a better term, and then that creatine is spit out into the body and taken up by most of the cells. So we make about a gram of creatine every day, and the rest comes from our diet. So if we turn to the next slide, as mentioned, exogenous, meaning your diet, people consume about a gram of creatine every single day, none if you're a vegan vegetarian. And people have shown that they have very low levels of creatine in their body. If someone's calling in now from Norway or from the Netherlands, they estimate that 10% of the population has very high intake, as much as anybody who's supplementing, because they eat a lot of herring, which is a fish that's known to have the highest concentration of creatine in its flesh. So we get creatine every day from our diet, and it's made in the liver. After a precursor is made in the kidneys and the pancreas. Most of it's taken up into muscle, but there's also very high concentration in the brain. And the creatine in our body is converted to creatinine, which many doctors will measure as a convenient indicator of your kidney function. And people originally thought that creatine was going to cause damage, because you can see here that you'll increase creatinine a little bit, but that's not because the kidneys aren't working, it's because you're just making more of it every day. So that needs to be considered in interpreting a creatinine level, because they'll be falsely slightly elevated by about 10 or 15%. Moving on to the next slide. So what we did is we looked at a variety of different disorders to see who was deficient and who might benefit from supplementation. So we looked at mitochondrial disease, muscular dystrophy, and inflammatory muscle disease. And across the board, we found about a 25 to 30% drop in total phosphocreatine and total creatine stores. Others have shown this as well in Milas syndrome in the brain, that the creatine stores in the brain and phosphocreatine stores are low. So why could this be of some benefit? A number of studies in humans have shown an increase in what's called fat-free mass or muscle mass. People have shown an increase in power in athletes. A whole bunch of studies have been done in animal models of ALS, Huntington's, and Parkinson's, all of which have secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, showing that there's a decrease in neurotoxicity. It's an antioxidant. And in a study where they essentially caused a stroke in a mouse model, there was protection, so there was less damage to the brain. So certainly from that perspective, if someone had Milas syndrome and had a propensity for stroke, it might be reasonable to have the creatine on board to protect against damage from a stroke. And it's been shown in several models. One was a muscular dystrophy model called the MDX, that mitochondrial function improved. And it's been shown to decrease something called apoptosis, which is increased in mitochondrial disease, which is a form of cell death. And that little triangle with that funny thing called a psi and the M, that's the mitochondrial membrane potential. So that was improved with creatine in a mouse model of brain injury. Next slide. So there have been a number of studies looking at creatine and mitochondrial disease. Most of them were fairly small. And what we have here is the study name, the dose of creatine, and the 5-1-1, 16-4-7-1 are the number of subjects in each study. So generally, the dose of creatine that we recommend, which has been shown in multiple studies to effectively get people's muscle up to the normal level, is 0.1 gram per kilogram per day in kids, and in adults the maximum dose would be 5 grams, which essentially is 2 level teaspoons a day. And we usually recommend just mixing it up with breakfast, because creatine normally comes in as part of food. And if we look at the outcome here, you can see that for the first one, there was a 12.1% improvement in function. The second one, there were some improvements in the brain MRI. Third one, there was an improvement in symptoms. In the Klopstock study in blue there, the power output was up 23%. The Borsch study, there were better symptoms. In our study in 1997, we found an increase in high-intensity power. So when people were having their leg electrically shocked to see how strong their muscle was, we had about an 11% improvement. And then the last one, there was an improvement in exercise tolerance and a decrease in headaches. The important point there is that the side effects were pretty minimal in these individuals. In the second study, that single case report, they used a really high dose, which we don't recommend, of 20 grams. And as I mentioned before, that would increase the creatinine. So they thought that that could be a sign of renal damage, but it's just because you had so much creatine coming in, you increased creatinine, so it was falsely elevated. So this was our study here that we published. It was what's called a crossover study. So everybody got the drug and everybody got placebo, and neither ourselves nor the subjects knew what they were getting until the end of the study. And this was not funded by industry. It was self-funded through some donations. So we gave patients a moderate dose loading for 2 weeks, which we now know isn't necessary. We only use 5 grams now, which is 1 level teaspoon. And then we had them on 4 grams per day. That should be G per D, not D per D, for a week. And what we found is their grip strength and their foot strength power increased. In the short term, we didn't see an increase in their oxygen consumption. But on the right there, you can see in orange is their starting strength on creatine and on placebo. Same people, repeated measures. And after 1 minute performance, you can see that the strength was always higher in the creatine group. So again, not sure what sort of activities people are doing, but certainly, you know, if you're going out and doing a little bit of carpentry or gardening, whatever it might be, there does seem to be a little bit more power output and less fatigue in the creatine group. So the next one here is just a quick little story called Not Performing Well. So this was a triathlete who came in as a study volunteer. We were doing muscle biopsies looking for lipids. And what we found were these things called paracrystalline inclusions. So if you look at the bottom right there, that is an electron micrograph of muscle. And those little squiggly lines are paracrystalline inclusions, which are found in about 50 to 60% of our patients with mitochondrial disease. And they indicate an increase in oxidative stress. So you know, we were a little bit shocked. We thought, this is weird. This guy's supposed to be a good athlete. You know, why does he have these paracrystalline inclusions? So we actually sequenced his mitochondrial DNA, and we found that he had a cytochrome B mutation. And the cytochrome B mutations are associated with exercise intolerance. So this is interesting because it gets to 2 points. One, he actually was able to complete triathlons, and he did sports, but he had done it his whole life. So essentially, because he was always an athlete in training, in spite of his mitochondrial cytochrome B mutation, he was compensating for it. Now, when we look back on our study, he definitely had the lowest VO2 max of all of our patients, but it was certainly much higher than a sedentary person. So if we go to the next slide, what we did is we wanted to see whether anything would help him. And so we it'll take me a second to go through this. What we did is we wanted to check his cells versus a healthy person's cells and see if the mitochondrial DNA truly was the reason for his paracrystalline inclusions. So what we did is we get a cancer cell line, which will just keep growing and growing and growing, and we take out the mitochondria by essentially irradiating it. And then what we can do is take his cells and we can pop the nucleus out and we fuse this cancer cell with the patient's cells. So what we have then is a new cell that's got the same, what's called nucleus, but it's got his bad mitochondria in it. And then we do that with some healthy cells. So then what we can do is we can ask the question, are those mitochondria that he has with this new mutation truly causing his disease? And then can we use it to see if we can come up with a therapy? So next slide. So essentially what we did is in red are the healthy people's cells, and blue are his cells. And what we did is first said, well, you know, does his disease actually cause a problem? So you can see the blue bars are lower than the red bars, and that just means that fewer of his cells survived when we removed glucose. If we removed glucose and added oxidative stress, that's the middle bars there, again, more of his cells died than the healthy people. But when we added creatine, we completely protected it. So what this shows is, yes, his mutation is causing a problem, but we can protect this person by adding creatine. Then on the second slide to the right, again, we showed that if we remove oxygen and we take out the sugar, the cells don't survive very well, but we could rescue that with coenzyme Q10 and with creatine. So this was a way almost of personalized medicine, where we showed that the creatine and the CoQ10 would be supplements that should work for his specific mutation. Now, for most of the people on this call, you're not going to have the luxury of having a research scientist go through all of these expensive tests to prove it, and therefore we need to rely on the clinical trials to see in a larger population, do these supplements actually provide benefit? So we put this guy on these supplements, and we found that most of the paracrystalline inclusions went away. So if you go to the next slide, we put him on creatine, we biopsied him, and we got rid of all of his paracrystalline inclusions, which was pretty exciting. So we'll go back to the next slide. It says consequences of mitochondrial dysfunction, and there's an arrow pointing to the CoQ10 there, and that's what most people are on with mitochondrial disease, and that's where most interest has been. So if we go to the next slide. So this is a list of all the studies that have looked at coenzyme Q10. So ones that have shown some positive effect there. There are 108 total subjects in these studies. No effect. There are 24 subjects in those two studies that showed no effect. And from a safety perspective, people have gone to very high doses of coenzyme Q10, especially in CoQ10 deficiency syndromes, which usually cause ataxia, more common in children. And it seems to be very well tolerated. What we and others have found is that there can be some stomach upset issues. So when we start any mitochondrial supplement, we always start giving the supplement with food because there's fewer stomach issues, and that's the way we evolved to eat our supplements and vitamins is with food, and that tends to decrease the stomach side effects. We also would recommend that you don't start all of the supplements in a big cocktail all at once. You take one for a week, take another for a week, and go from there. The other point I'll make about coenzyme Q10 is that there are liquid formulations and gel formulations, which seem to be well absorbed, but the powder is not. So if you have capsules that have CoQ10 powder inside, you may as well throw them down the toilet because you're essentially pooping down the toilet because none of those are absorbed, and it's a total waste of your money. So make sure that it's a liquid cap or a gel. So at Costco, for example, if you buy your CoQ10, it's a good quality CoQ10. If you poke it, you can actually squish out the gel-like liquid inside. Okay. So we did a clinical study. Actually, I won't spend too much time on this because we want to get to the exercise stuff. And we showed some improvement in function on CoQ10, but we'll just whip through that because we've shown that. There was a study called idebenone and a disease called Leber hereditary optic neuropathy, which showed a very tiny effect. So the idebenone was once very popular. It's essentially a coenzyme Q10 analog that was designed when the old CoQ10 formulations that were powders weren't being absorbed. And it was all the rage in Friedreich ataxia, but that's recently been shown to not be effective. And so the mitochondrial disease called Friedreich's, we no longer provide idebenone, and it's been delisted in our formulary. And so we actually now, for Friedreich's, use our mitochondrial cocktail as opposed to the idebenone. And there are some people that still think it might be of some benefit with Leber's, but they had they had to tease it apart big time to try and actually prove any clinical benefit. So it's not a dramatically beneficial therapy. And so if we go to the next slide, which is clinical trials in mitochondrial disease, you probably took a look at my slides and said, wow, a lot of these were case studies or two or three people. And that's a real problem. A lot of them are small numbers, or the researchers or the patients knew that they were on a drug or a placebo. So in our study, we used what's called the double-blind trial. So neither ourselves nor the subjects knew what they were on, which is the only way to do it. And unfortunately, very few people have used that, partially because a lot of these supplements and even exercise are not patentable. So the big pharma companies have no interest. And when we did our stuff, I used my own personal money to fund all of our research in treatment for mitochondrial disease, because no granting agency at all had any interest in it, and every grant that I applied for was rejected, so we just went ahead and did the studies anyhow. So one of the issues, too, I'll move down to number three, that I saw with the mitochondrial disease cocktail trials, is that in the quote-unquote cocktails, a lot of people were using 4 or 5 antioxidants, which really doesn't make a lot of sense. So if you have 4 or 5 antioxidants, really only need 2, and that doesn't make sense. And then another case, we're suffering from the opposite, and that was there was only a single agent that was given. So one of the suggestions we came up with is, what are the 3 main pathways by which mitochondria are sick? And those pathways include oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction. Oops, sorry, my slide just went forward. I'll just restart that. Yeah, so oxygen stress or the reactive oxygen species, there's a reduction in alternative energy sources, which we mentioned creatine, and a reduction in the flux through the mitochondria. So much in the way in which we now treat cancer by attacking many of the final common pathways instead of just one pathway, we felt that the best way to treat mitochondrial disease was to target these common pathways. So we did a clinical trial with a mitochondrial cocktail. Geez, I don't know why my computer's not working now. It just stopped on me. And as I mentioned, we felt this was reasonable. So we move on to the next slide, mitochondrial cocktail. Oh, my. Now my slides aren't working at all.
You're over halfway there, Dr. Tarnopolsky.
My goodness. Okay. So let's move to mitochondrial cocktail. It says marriage, molecular genetics, and metabolism. So this was a study by a colleague of mine in the nutrition department, originally in Alberta, and they looked at 12 patients with Leber's and CPO, and they did a study with a mitochondrial cocktail, and they studied them before 3, 6, and 12 months. Now, I have here open, so this was not a crossover study, so keep that in mind. So they used coenzyme Q10, carnitine, which, again, we don't recommend unless your levels are low, B-complex, vitamin K, and vitamin C. And what they found is that, yes, the CoQ10 was absorbed, and they did see an increase in the blood that was about fivefold. And they found that the what's called ATP production in their white blood cells was improved. So it seemed that this was stimulating and improving mitochondrial function. If we turn to slide 31, this is the first randomized double-blind crossover study in mitochondrial disease that we published in 2007. In this study, we had patients for 2 months on the cocktail, 2 month washout, and then they were crossed over to placebo or vice versa. And what we did is we used coenzyme Q10 as an antioxidant to bypass complex 1, mixed with vitamin E, which is an antioxidant and also helps to replenish CoQ10, creatine, which was an alternative energy source, and alpha-lipoic acid, which is a mitochondrial antioxidant, and it replenishes coenzyme Q10. We had 16 patients who had CPO and Milas syndrome. And what we showed here is, yes, the coenzyme Q10 we used was absorbed, which is important because in the old studies, the powder wasn't absorbed. To the right there, that 2OH2DG is oxidative stress, and that was lower. And that's important because oxidative stress, we think, is causing further damage to the cells. So if we turn to the next slide, number 32, importantly, we showed that lactic acid or lactate was lower. Because we think that's a reflection of mitochondrial damage. So the lower it is, the better the mitochondria function is. And then that thing called 8-isoprostanes is another marker of oxidative stress, so that was indeed lower. So we'll turn to the exercise, and there's only a few studies here, so it won't take too long. So the slide number 33, what we have here is a sedentary person sitting back, doing high-intensity exercise and getting what's called muscle hypertrophy, which is where the red arrow is pointing, versus endurance exercise, where you do longer duration activity and get more mitochondria. So can you actually do weight training? If we turn to slide 34, my colleague, Dr. Tanya Tavasalo, has done most of the work in weight training with mitochondrial disease, and she published a study a few years ago with my colleagues Ron Haller and Douglas Turnbull, where they took 8 patients with CPEO who had a deletion of their mitochondrial DNA, and they did standard weight training, very much like what you would see if you went down to the gym at a local YMCA and did a training program. So they did knee extension and flexion and leg press. So you can see the lady on the right there is doing what's called knee extension, and they worked them up to 85% of their maximal capacity, and they did 3 to 6 sets of 6 to 8 repetitions, and they did that for a period of 3 months. And what you can see is that their leg extension and their leg press went up 15 and 25%, so there's an improvement in their strength, but also it didn't seem to cause any damage, so their CK before and after did not change. And in this study, they also showed an improvement in the mitochondrial function with muscle biopsies. So Tanya did a couple of other studies with endurance exercise. If we turn to number 35 there, again, the reason why people were interested is that will increase mitochondria. So 2 studies were published in the same issue of the Brain Journal with endurance exercise. The first one was a European group who had 20 patients with mitochondrial disease. 14 had point mutations, things like Leber's and Milas, and they had 16 healthy controls. So they trained folks for 3 months at 70% of their VO2 max 4 times per week, and they found a 67% increase in what's called citrate synthase, which means about a 67% increase in total mitochondria. And what was really cool is their VO2 max went up 67%. And that's important because many patients that we study with mitochondrial disease have a maximal oxygen consumption, which is almost tapped out when they're just doing daily activities, which is why a lot of patients just, you know, trying to work and do their daily activities get so fatigued. And importantly, from a safety perspective, the muscle looked nice and healthy, and there was no increase in muscle enzyme release called CK. So I'll finish and take some questions with the last one here. And this was, again, another study. This was by Tanya in patients with CPEO, which is a slightly different type of mitochondrial disease. And they did a very similar thing. They trained for 14 weeks, identical training program to what I just described, and then they stopped for 14 weeks. And what they showed is that their work capacity went up, their VO2 went up, but importantly, their quality of life improved. So the SF-36 is a marker of quality of life, and so people felt better, they had better life quality following the training. What was important is that the mitochondrial DNA content and mutations didn't shift, so they all stayed about the same. No worsening, which was a concern that they had. And the excuse me, it's darn cold. And their muscle looked very healthy. Now, the take-home point, though, is if you don't use it, you lose it. So when they stopped training for 14 weeks, they went right back down to baseline. And so that was the take-home message there. So the other stuff is a little bit more theoretical. It's all of our basic science work, which you've probably seen me talk about at some conferences and stuff like the UMDF meeting. But I think the more interesting thing at this point would be to just take some questions that people might have and talk about some of the practical aspects of how do we transition these things to patients.
So much interesting and relevant information. And Dr. Turnipolsky, thank you so much. I know Mary Beth and I have both gotten a few questions that have come in over email, and so
sure,
we'll address those first before we open up the lines. Let me just remind anyone who's listening that I will open up the lines for you to ask your question. But if for some reason you'd like us to be your voice and ask a question on your behalf, you can email us, director@mitoaction.org or mito411@mitoaction.org. So, Dr. Turnipolsky, a question that came in about carnitine, and speaking a little bit more about finding a normal range or an optimum range. This person was asking about if there's an ideal range or if there's a reason to do a boost, and if that then boost would, I guess, kind of provide a bolus that would provide an optimum range instead of building up gradually. And if you could speak a little bit about maybe the bigger picture of optimum ranges for water and fat-soluble supplements as a whole, I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, tough one. Because, you know, there's a little bit of difference from lab to lab in terms of what the ranges are. Certainly for carnitine, it's pretty established across North America. There's a thing called CLIA certification, which is a lab certification. So the ranges that people have for the normal range are pretty similar, you know, if you're in Texas or you live up in Canada. So I think getting someone into the normal range is important for all vitamins and minerals, things like iron. So, for example, the ferritin stores, zinc, and other important minerals. And the same is true of carnitine. What I'm not a fan of is that there seems to be a general feeling across almost every mitochondrial disease specialist except for me that giving people carnitine somehow is beneficial. And there's no evidence to support this. There's not been one clinical trial that's shown that providing people with L-carnitine improves function in mitochondrial disease. In fact, the only thing really that seems to benefit from carnitine is, one, if there's a deficiency state, which has always been my point, is that measure it. If in the CLIA-certified lab the levels are low, we agree completely with supplementing a person till they get into the normal range. So usually it comes as something called Carnitor, and the dose is 330 milligrams. And we usually start with that twice a day with food and then recheck in a couple of months to make sure that they're in the CLIA-certified normal range. But to supercompensate or to generally give everyone carnitine seems illogical. And the world expert, in my mind, in carnitine physiology and biochemistry is Dr. Ingrid Tain at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. And I've discussed this with Ingrid, and she agrees with me that other than supplementing a deficiency, or in rare diseases like primary carnitine deficiency, where it's absolutely essential to replace carnitine, there really is no role for it in treatment, unlike coenzyme Q10, where there's quite a bit of evidence that even if your levels are normal, providing extra in mitochondrial disease, that's one instance where it could be beneficial. So the only supplements that seem to be helpful in higher the normal ranges or to really push the dose would be the CoQ10, alpha-lipoic acid, vitamin E, and creatine would be giving people more than what you'd normally be getting.
And so to follow up on that, is there ever a reason for mitochondrial disease patients to be at a greater than normal range?
In carnitine? No.
Or in other supplements?
No, carnitine definitely not. Coenzyme Q10, you know, the doses that we're giving for the kids with CoQ10 deficiency, we have to give them huge doses just to get them into the normal range. In a patient who has, you know, Milas syndrome, they are almost certainly will have normal CoQ10 levels in their muscle, and that would be an instance where it doesn't matter. That would be a scenario where giving them more and supplementing on top of a sufficiency is likely to be of benefit. So we didn't do muscle biopsies on our patients with the in the Milas and CPO where we gave creatine and lipoic acid, but almost certainly their levels would be within the normal range. It's very rare to have coenzyme Q10 deficiency in muscle, with the exception of a few specific genetic diseases. And so in spite of that, giving them more clearly showed benefit. It reduced their oxidative stress, and it reduced their lactate levels. But there's a very specific biochemical reason why that's the case. And it really gets to the same point as, for example, a vitamin B12 deficiency. If it's low, it's devastating. You can have somebody end up in a wheelchair and demented if it's not treated. Bring them up to a normal range and they do fine. But there's a lot of athletes out there that think, well, B12, it must be good for you. So they take huge doses and massive infusions of B12 and get up to three times the upper limit of normal. But the cell regulates itself and it does absolutely nothing. So it's a complete waste of time, money, and effort.
Perfect. Mary Beth, I'll let you ask a question that you've received via email. Thank you, Dr. Tarnopolsky. Go ahead, Mary Beth.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Tarnopolsky. Such great information. Our first question comes from Canada, and the woman who's asking the question cares for her sister who has mitochondrial disease as well as her own self who has mitochondrial disease. And she's wondering, how can she fit in exercise when just doing her basic chores and helping take care of her sister just wears her out, both physically with fatigue as well as pain and things like that? She's been told repeatedly to increase her exercise, but just hasn't found a way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a question I hear frequently, and it's not just from patients with mitochondrial disease, but, you know, healthy older adults, middle-aged people who need to get their butt in gear and exercise, and even young people. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I don't have time, life's too busy, and it makes me fatigued. But remember that if done properly, starting off very, very gradually, we have a DVD that we provide to our patients to tell them to listen to their body, start off at lower intensity and gradually ramp up and get used to it, what you're doing is pushing that fatigue ceiling up slowly. Because if I were to take a patient with Milas syndrome who had a VO2 max of 10 milliliters per kilogram per minute, which is just a little bit above just sitting around not doing anything, and I put them on a bike and I said, okay, go and ride for half an hour, it's physically impossible. After a minute, they'd be pretty much falling off the bike. So you can't use just standard exercise guidelines for a patient. You have to take each person as an individual and start off with a very low amount. And so what we usually do is that if somebody finds aerobic activity like biking or cycling or these sort of things to be difficult, we say, okay, that's fine. We're going to start with some weight training, because weight training is anaerobic and doesn't even involve your mitochondria. But what happens is you get a little bit of a spillover. So generally what we would do is someone who's really short of breath walking or cycling, we would bring them in and do, you know, a little bit of weights with their arms, some exercise with their legs, build up the strength a little bit, get them used to doing physical activity, and then very carefully titrate in some endurance-type activity. So those are the ways that we approach counseling people for exercise. But then it gets back to, well, how do you find time? And my point there is it's not a lot of time. You know, really, it's a half an hour a day maximum, 4 days a week. We'll provide people with the benefits that we described in those papers that Tanya and others did. So half an hour a day, 4 days a week is 2 hours out of your entire week. And let's see here. So that's 168 hours. So 2 divided by 168. Yeah, that's 1% of your time you're spending doing the exercise. So it's a very small fraction. And so, you know, for lack of a better term, suck it up, sunshine. It's good for you. And you're only spending 1% of your week doing it. What I would say, though, practically, do it in a way in which you're not wasting time if you feel that's what it's doing. So what we often do is tell people, you know, if you're going to watch the news, that's taking 15 to 20 minutes to watch the news. Why don't you do it on a stationary bike? So things like a reclining bike we find are good because if people have balance issues, they're scared of getting off of a bike, these sort of things, you can sit on a reclining bike and watch television. And that way you kill two birds with one stone. And if a person in North America tells me that they don't watch television, they're certainly the underdog. Most people spend almost 2 hours a day watching TV. So spend 1% of your time on a bike watching TV or reading a magazine, and that's a good way to squeeze it into your time frame.
Absolutely. Good motivation for everyone as we go into the end of 2016 and some goals for 2017 and, you know, and I appreciate everything that you're saying. We're going to squeeze in a couple more questions if you are okay on time.
Yep, I've got another 5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so speaking again about creatine this time. So I had a question from a patient asking about tolerance with liver dysfunction, specifically about creatine, but also I would like to widen that up and know that I've had some patients who've also had some concerns about dehydration and kidney dysfunction with creatine. Could you speak to approaches to managing that, since creatine can really be sucking the water right out of?
Yeah, that's completely untrue. I'm not sure where that came from. What happens when you take creatine, your levels are deficient, your cell swells a little bit, so women will gain about a half a pound of water inside their muscle, and men will gain about a pound of muscle. But if you look at a half a pound of muscle slowly coming in over a period of about a week, which is about the time frame where that would occur, and a plasma volume result is going to be about 6 liters. It's an infinitesimally tiny fraction. So if they're worried about that, they should you know, maybe drink a half a cup of extra water per day. It's a tiny amount. And all of the studies that I've actually looked at that have never shown dehydration, even in wrestlers who are losing massive amounts and trying to drop, you know, kilos of weight by dehydrating themselves, there's no evidence that creatine does that. So that's a complete urban legend. The second thing is liver dysfunction. There isn't a single paper in the world that's shown liver dysfunction in humans, absolutely not, never been shown. In one study with guys who were on a football team, there was an increase in one liver enzyme called ALT, but what they didn't realize is that actually comes from muscle, and when they're, you know, doing football and pounding themselves, it was just their sports that caused the ALT to go up. It had nothing to do with the creatine, and it was not different in those taking creatine or placebo. So there's no evidence ever that it causes liver dysfunction. The only thing we've seen in one animal study is that mice seem to be a little sensitive to super high doses, and they get a little bit of liver inflammation. But rats don't and humans don't. So that's completely inappropriate information. The final thing is the kidney dysfunction. Yes, as I mentioned time and time again, creatinine goes up a little bit because creatine is the precursor to creatinine. So it goes up about 10 or 15%. And so people inappropriately said, oh, it must mean that the kidneys aren't working. But that's because they don't understand biology. And we conveniently use creatinine because it is reflective of our muscle mass, and it's something that it would be reflective of your kidney dysfunction if you hold muscle mass constant and you hold creatine intake constant. But if you take creatine, it's going to go up a little bit. And so people think, oh, my kidneys aren't working. But if you actually do what's called creatinine clearance, where you measure what comes out in the pee and what's in the blood, creatine has absolutely no effect on kidney function. Or if you use other methods of looking at renal function, there's no effect. Again, all bets are off if people take stupid high doses, which, you know, some bodybuilders take. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about proper randomized double-blind trials where people are taking, an appropriately prescribed dose. And this has been done in ALS studies. It's been done in muscular dystrophy studies. We've had patients on it for 30 years with no evidence whatsoever of any dysfunction of the organs. And keep in mind, we're dealing with a deficiency state that we're trying to keep up with. We're not super compensating people. So we're just trying to get them back to a normal level, not give them huge doses. And that's why for patients, we say 0.1 gram per kilogram per day to a maximum of 5 grams, which is only about 3 times your normal dietary intake.
Excellent. We're running out of time, and so Mary Beth, I'm going to let you address that question, and then I'll tell people that you can email us your additional questions, and we'll consolidate those and work with Dr. Tarnopolsky to get some answers, and we can publish those on our blog with the information from today. Go ahead, Mary Beth.
Sure. James from Michigan, he's 46 and has now been diagnosed with mitochondrial disease as for about the last 10 years. He used to be more active. He was able to hike and bike and do things like that. But since the mitochondrial disease has really hit him hard, he's become much less active, stopped exercising, and gained a lot of weight and feels like his metabolism is very, very slow and wants to know if he can use exercise to kind of jumpstart his metabolism because he feels like he's not really getting the nutrients, yet he's overweight.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult scenario because when you're overweight, it's uncomfortable to exercise because you have to pick that weight up and carry it. So certainly, if someone's overweight, we would suggest, you know, running or jogging is not a good thing because it doesn't feel comfortable on your knees. Things like an elliptical, reclining bike, these sort of things would be the way to start. But remember, too, that if this person has not exercised for more than 2 weeks, you pretty much feel like you're right back at square one. And so they have to go through that whole process of gradually ramping it back up again. So it will take them some time to get back into it. But again, someone like that, you might want to start with a mixed program, doing more weight-type activity, lifting weights, these sort of things, and doing some sort of activity that would be not weight-bearing, so things like a reclining bike. We like the elliptical, too. It's very smooth. It's easy on the joints, and also gets your arms involved, too. But again, for most patients with disability, it's no different than a person who's middle-aged or an older adult who wants to start exercising. It is damn hard, and 80% of the population doesn't like doing it. But if you know that it's going to be good for you, and especially with mitochondrial disease, where we know there's a greater risk of diabetes, and that alone, if you have diabetes, which is effectively treated certainly improved with exercise, that will further damage the mitochondria. So obesity and diabetes are a horrible combo with mitochondrial disease because they exacerbate the underlying mitochondrial dysfunction. And one of the best countermeasures to that is regular exercise. So if you like it or not, it's good for you. So, you know, unfortunately, people have to make that extra effort, more so with mitochondrial disease, even than the general population, because the benefits are far more extensive for a patient with mitochondrial disease than somebody who's just your average Joe on the street.
I totally think that is a terrific take-home message to all of us, and for those just starting out, that part about going slow, finding something that you're not going to hate doing, so that you can get up tomorrow and try it again.
Yeah, and we also recommend a day of rest, too. So not only do you start really slow, but the body has to recover because anything that's stressful, the way exercise works with mitochondrial disease is we actually stress them a little bit. You will feel more tired and fatigued, and then you've got to let that recover over the next day. So generally, we rest and stretch and take the next day off and then go back to it and then rest and stretch and take the day off and then go back to it. And once you get used to it, then you can obviously slowly start adding in. And, you know, we have some patients that exercise 7 days a week. I've got a guy with Milas syndrome at 78% heteroplasmy and almost 90% in his muscle. I mean, by all accounts, he should be dead now, and he's 38 And 10 years ago, he ran a 302 marathon, which, if anybody knows, is unbelievably good even for an able-bodied person. And
wow.
He's completely normal. He has no hearing loss, no diabetes, no visual problems, never had a stroke and seizure, and yet I cared for his mom, who died of severe complications of Milas syndrome with the same level heteroplasmy, and she was only 8 years older than he was and was disabled for many, many, many years to decades before. And yet he just started this when he was young, didn't know that his mom had mitochondrial disease, and had always been an athlete. So he, he's certainly protecting himself by exercise. But, he's my world record extreme that I've ever seen.
Wow, your stories are so inspirational.
Certainly seems like that, as soon as you get the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease for yourself or your child, the next prescription would be to join an exercise program. And, really, I think as a patient community, there's a certain amount of resistance, confusion, and, uncertainty about how to approach this, but it sounds like the evidence is really overwhelming on how this is a proven and effective mechanism to improve the baseline for mito patients, and that's really exciting because that's what we all really hope for.
Exactly.
Dr. Turnipolsky, I appreciate your time, and I know we're running out, and I know there are lots of people who didn't get to ask their questions live, but I want to respect our schedule. So I'm going to ask people to please send us an email with your questions, and Mary Beth and I will work on consolidating those and working to put some answers together and publishing those on our website. And perhaps we should plan a part two where we do, kind of a recap of the latest research and leave even more time for questions in 2017.
Great. Thank you very much.
Everyone, please join me in thanking Dr. Turnipolsky. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise and for graciously sharing that with us. And certainly we hope you feel better. And everyone, have a great rest of the year and looking forward to many exciting things coming forward.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.